No, I'm not asking Scotty to bring me up. This is my it's a Creative Zen Micro, and I'm sincerely hoping that it's recording right now. It appears to be. And what I'm actually doing in this presentation is, in the process of delivering the talk, creating a resource. So if you speak during my talk and possibly some of the discussion after, there will be evidence. I'm going to start the slides in just a second, because my presentation is almost the opposite of the one that just preceded. And sitting there, I was thinking cynically, because I'm cynical, well, we got free as in beer, and now we're going to get free as in freedom. I think we have very two different concepts going on here. And I'm not going to respond directly, but I will respond implicitly as I go through what I have to say. And again, I too am limited by time, and I realized as I was writing this morning that I could add another 15 pages on a separate topic, but I won't. It's not another time. And sorry about the display like this, but again, my windows are messed up, so you'll have to live with that. And I have to look at it there because I can't see it here. The concept of open educational resources and OERs was a bit of a move for me, but that's okay. Comes with it implicit the idea that these are resources that will be shared. And through the sharing, we see the value of these resources. And there's been a lot of talk about how the value of resources is developed, the leveraging of the value of work. In a traditional publishing model, for example, much work is produced, but a much smaller percentage of that work actually makes it out into the community. Leveraging the value of the work, just in the sense that it's shareable, it becomes more accessible for the author. It means a wider readership. There was discussion yesterday, and there is evidence in surveys, and I believe I cite one, showing that work that is published openly is more frequently cited, more frequently referenced. And it maximizes the value of the investment for funders, because when resources are distributed openly, they reach the widest range of users, which means the per reader or per user cost of an investment in a resource becomes lower. And I think we all agree, I was pleased yesterday to discover that, as someone said, I am indeed among friends here, which as an aside most surprised me, but it made me very happy. I think we all agree about the value of educational resources. We may agree a bit less on what we mean by resources, and there was some discussion of that yesterday. And of course it includes things like courseware, of course it includes things like content and even academic papers and things like that, and the famous or the infamous learning objects, and we can talk about those if we want. I view this as wider, and I view it as wider for a very specific reason. Not just learning materials, but also aids and supports, things like class outlines, curriculum, programs. We see an awful lot of that are produced out there. So we're thinking beyond just courseware, and therefore, you know, the model that was given yesterday, and everybody was nodding, and I was nodding, you know, but the content and so on, is a little bit narrow. But it's not just digital resources either. Like, I'm standing here in a room in a very nice hotel in Malmo, Sweden. I'm a resource. I'm even a shareable resource, and here's the proof, but I'm not a digital resource. And I think we see a lot of that too. Learning, as we know, is not just getting a book or a learning object or some content. It involves interaction. It involves that second phase, the tutorial or the support. And a lot of times that happens in real life. It happens with a person. So I'm thinking much wider than just digital resources. And we talked about open yesterday a little bit. And I thought about this, but my first instinct was to contrast it with commercial resources. And yet, it doesn't really work, does it? Because you can have resources offered by non-commercial organizations, such as publishing societies, which are nonetheless not open because they charge access fees And you can have resources offered by commercial companies that are free and open. And the classic example is Google. Google is free and accessible to everybody. And it makes it it becomes an open resource in that way. And open to me, well, it does imply free as in free beer, but it means more than that because, and this is something that comes from the field of open source software, it's not just being able to access the resource, but it's being able to use the resource, often to repurpose the resource, to do something with the resource. Now, it does not mean necessarily without constraints, and we may talk about that. There are various licensing conditions in that. But it does mean a certain degree of access.
Oh, yeah.
No, I haven't. Okay. So anyhow, I'm writing up my paper, and of course it's OECD, so the first thing I thought about was money. And when I looked at it, because I actually did have to stop and look at it, and what I saw was a proliferation of funding methods. I know you're all familiar with this. Otherwise you probably wouldn't be in this room, but I'm just going to review them briefly. The endowment model. The Stanford Encyclopedia is a good example of that, where they're raising or want to raise $4 million, and then they'll support the encyclopedia off the interest from that endowment. The membership model, and Sakai is a good example, I've seen some other examples, where a group or a consortium of institutions, such as universities, gets together, and each one of them contributes a certain amount of money in order to sustain the initiative. The donations model, which is most popular in the communities I run in, where you put up a PayPal thing or something like that and say, please give us money, otherwise we'll die. And members or users or whatever contribute money. A common one is called the conversion model, and that actually sounded kind of like rice. The connection system, where you offer something for free and then eventually you commercialize it, and then you use the commercial aspect, maybe not, right? I know, I'm just kidding. You get impressions, right? But we see this in the open source community. MySQL, there's the MySQL that is open source software, and then there's the commercial enterprise that follows from that. Oh, you see that with various Linux initiatives as well. Contributor pay, which is an interesting one, because you actually pay for the privilege of producing a resource that will be freely shared by all, and you would think that could not possibly work. But the world of academic publishing is a very interesting and strange world, where the authors are already used to paying and not getting anything back. And so it works in something like, for example, the Public Library of Science, where the author or sometimes a foundation who is backing the author will pay PLOS for the expenses involved in publishing and maintaining the resource online. Sponsorship, and this is something that we see from time to time, where a company or an organization will find value, typically brand value, in associating itself with an educational resource. And Microsoft does quite a bit of stuff like that. And the example I put up there is the Stanford iTunes project. Apple is involved in that. It's providing educational resources, for now free, but there'll probably be a conversion model as well. And what Apple gets out of that is brand recognition and increased demand for its product, and it does that by providing the free resources. And that's a model I think that we'll see much more of. It's the old slogan I used to say, Apple uses music to sell iPods, not iPods to sell music. Institutional, where an organization, a university typically, will see it as part of its mandate to produce resources. This is just what it does. It's, as David Wiley said yesterday, it's the right thing to do. And then as part of its mandate, it contributes part of its operating budget to that. Very related to that, obviously, are governmental initiatives. I'm one of those, actually. I work for the National Research Council of Canada. And our government pays money, pays me even. I don't know how that happened, but it did, in order to produce resources that can be used and shared by the community. SchoolNet is another project in Canada. It's run by, I think it's Industry Canada or Heritage Canada, which is a network of resources that are available to teachers. And it's just produced, and teachers across Canada are able to access these resources. And it's because it's thought of as part of the mission of the Government of Canada to produce these resources. And then you might think this is an odd inclusion in this listing, partnerships and exchanges. And I picked up on one between Memorial University of Newfoundland and the Brazilian University where there's an exchange. It's not necessarily an exchange of funds, but basically what happens is through the process of partnership, free resources are produced for learners who are in Brazil. And so the Memorial Brazilian Partnership is, in fact, a way of funding, if you will, or sustaining open educational resources. So those are the models. And there's an awful lot of models. Now, when I was looking at sustainability, I looked, because I look everywhere, beyond just the financial support. And it seems to me that there are several other categories of sustainability, which I'm going to go through very briefly. I know, because I'm not going to have a whole lot of time here. And because we know that, from our own experiences, both working with our governments and elsewhere, that simply having a lot of money isn't sufficient to sustain a resource. I know that because I've been on a project that had a lot of money and it still wasn't sustainable. One of these things is technical. And on reflection, as I looked at it, I'm seeing that a lot of the technical considerations are in fact driven by funding considerations. Consider the whole concept of learning objects, shareable, reusable, discoverable learning resources. And a large motivation for that is based on the need for funding. The idea is that if you can produce resources that are shareable in this way, you push down the cost of funding. But that brings us into the whole question of what the technical support is going to be. What technologically these resources are going to look at. Like, there are two major things which I classified as free use as opposed to adapted and localized. And it's a difference in technical model of content, where on the one model, you just get something and you use it. It's like a textbook. You wouldn't tear out the pages and paste them up on the wall. This is not that kind of resource. As opposed to the adapt and localize. Other technical considerations that come in as well are just, and this was mentioned yesterday, the discoverability of resources. It doesn't matter how many resources you have if you can't find them. And indeed, in my own experience, because I do look out there on the web, my own belief is that there is not now even a shortage of educational resources or even open educational resources. I see site after site with hundreds of resources. I look at Flickr and tens of thousands of Creative Commons licensed pictures. The PodSafe Music Network, again, with hundreds and soon to be thousands of reusable resources. All kinds of resources there, it's just we can't find them. And I think that becomes a consideration. And even this mechanism is going to place constraints on what we view as open. People who know me from the learning object community will have heard me rail about content federations and identity federations. And a federated system is a mechanism for providing search through a distributed network, but the creation of a federated system creates a barrier to access. Because access to a federated system only exists for institutions that are members of that federation. And so, if you have to be in a university as a university student in order to access this federation, maybe the resource is free, but you have to have paid $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 worth of tuition. And to me, that structure of that network changes the nature of the open resources into some kind of subscriber fee. It's a hidden kind of fee. Well, it's not that hidden to the students. So the technical structure of the network that we set up influences whether or not our resources are open. Come back. Content models as well. And we talked about licensing yesterday, so I'm not going to go into that a lot. But I think that as we push our understanding of content, and we even saw that a little bit here yesterday, by open we're going to mean not just free as in free beer, not just free as in stuff we can pull off the shelf, but free as in freedom, in the sense that the content that we use, the open educational resources, are things that we can rework, remix, repurpose, redistribute to localize, and that came up a lot. And that in turn means that there is a semantical element to these resources, in the sense that the resources that are brought in need to be semantically relevant to the community in which they're used. The primary example, of course, is language, and it's useful to have a resource in the language that the students speak. But it extends a lot more beyond that. In Canada, and I'm sure in Europe, we run into issues of cultural sensitivity and things like that. And even like I put in my paper, like logical notation, you couldn't think, but there are different types of notation in formal logic. And if you've taught students using one notation, then to import a resource in another notation creates a dissonance for them. This is going to bring in, and this is the major point that I wanted to stress in what I had to say today, is that it puts into question the whole provider-consumer relationship. And we heard yesterday in the discussion the talk about the potential for cultural imperialism, the exporting of a certain model, and you heard all my cynical remarks about MIT and what they're up to. And I'm just kind of glad the recorder was off then. And what we're seeing, and we're seeing this outside the institutional arrangement, we're seeing this in the community at large, a shift from the model where there is a provider and a consumer and forever they shall stay apart to something like collaborative development. That came up a lot in the discussions, the UNESCO discussions from a couple of years ago. And we are seeing that. If you look at Wikipedia, for example, if you look at a lot of the new initiatives, we're seeing a lot more emphasis on collaborative development. So we cannot think of open educational resources, and I mean this quite literally. It's semantically not possible to think of open educational resources without at the same time thinking about the community that uses them. I need to underline that. And that brings us to staffing. And it was interesting, the Connections presentation, and it was the whole idea, oh, we want everyone to come to Connections. Everyone's come here. That's the whole sustainability model. And it's funny because, you know, it reflects in a way that traditional model where you bring people in, maybe you hire them, maybe you lure them in with nice software or something, and they'll come in and they'll produce things. And then those things will be sent out and consumed. And that is the traditional model, and we see that in many cases with open educational resources. But if you bring people in, if you hire staff, if you have professionals, that has huge implications on the cost. And you guys can all look at the numbers as well as I can, what it costs for the Open University to develop content, for example, as compared to what it costs for Wikipedia to develop content. And it's, you know, they're not even remotely close to orders of magnitude. And so consequently, in the field of open educational resources, we see a great deal of emphasis on volunteers. Now, I've talked before about how sustainability depends on the people who are providing the resources. What counts as sustainable is determined by whoever is funding it. And we saw all the different funding models, which means there are all kinds of different types of sustainability. But now sustainable becomes a question of what sustains the volunteers, what keeps them going. And we know that volunteers work under different motivations, non-financial motivations. And again, as David said, they're motivated by doing the right thing. And so our model of sustainability has to reflect that. Two major types of volunteer organization that I could detect in the open educational resources community. One of them is the community model. And you see that a lot in open source software. The Apache Foundation very explicitly a meritocracy. People play very definite roles and responsibilities. Again, with Apache, you've got like 30 or 40 or whatever vice presidents and all of that. Everybody does a particular thing. As opposed to that is what might be called the emergent model, where the identity of the user, I mean, you still have an identity, but that person's role is less important, and rather it's the way that they interact or work with the system. These are very different models. On the emergent model, I've got eBay up there, and that the participation in the community is undertaken through a series of small, autonomous, and usually self-directed actions. For example, DIG is a site that was mentioned yesterday, and participating in DIG means clicking either dig this or don't dig this, or dig this elevates a resource higher on the list, and don't dig this lowers it. It's a very simple quality measuring system. There are a lot of things like that, recommender systems and interaction systems where people do small actions in order to create information as a whole. And I think that if you take those two models and if you combine them with the idea of consumers and producers merging together, you get a lot of the approach that we find in the thing called Web 2.0. There was some discussion of this yesterday and some question of, you know, what is RSS? How does all of that work? And I didn't actually solve my CSS problems, and I don't have internet access, so I can't show you. But the whole idea is that the community becomes the entity that produces the resource. And the idea of Web 2.0 is that the mechanism of production is the same as the mechanism of consumption, that there is no real distinction to be drawn. But think about workflow. Think about how we traditionally develop resources. You know, the design, the content production, we'll run it through some pilot projects, all of that, and we'll do some evaluation in that. And the mechanisms that make this possible. And through every step of that process, and people have written like books, volumes of books on this, you know, oversight, management, quality control. The classic example I bring forward to highlight this is the example of Merlot. And Merlot, as you all know, is an open educational a repository of open educational objects. And Merlot operates on a peer review system such that the resources that come in are reviewed by a panel of peers, if you will. And this creates a bottleneck. I forget what the exact percentage was, but only a very small percentage of the resources that have been submitted to Merlot are reviewed. And so the choice becomes, choose between a completely unreviewed resource or one of very few that are available. The contrast to this mechanism of production with the structures and the controls as it says there, rethink the idea of producing, to decentralize the system, to disaggregate the system. This is what bothers me about connections and other initiatives. And they want everybody to come to them. And as soon as that happens, you get all kinds of issues of not just control, but scaling, management, resources, bandwidth. And if you look at the way resources are being produced on the web now, it's decentralized. It's uncontrolled. It's, you remember when you did the survey to find out what's being done in open educational resources, and it wasn't at the institutional level, it was at the individual level. And that is where a lot of this work is being done. And it's virtually invisible. Almost there. So, sustainable open educational resources. If we focus and fixate on content, I think we're missing actually 90% of the picture. And my own feeling is that this content is the least of the issues, particularly in an environment where content is produced on the fly through use. We can produce content like crazy. It's not hard. And people do produce content like crazy. There's, you know, a billion web users and how many billions of web pages, and a lot of those are open educational resources. The consideration of the community is key. But understanding the type of community that will foster the development of open resources is critical. We have to see not just a mechanism, not just a big machine. You pump money in one side, and it pops open resources on the other side. We have to see a model of production, of use, of distribution, where the existing structures are decentralized. Right now, we're working in a world where the models that we have implicitly, sometimes through funding and other times explicitly through our declarations and actions, are centralized, financially oriented, hierarchical, managed. And this type of organization often constitutes a set of barriers preventing the distribution of open educational resources. So I was, you know, asked to come here and talk about sustainability of resources, and I was hesitant to do it because I thought, well, you want me to contribute to these mechanisms that are actually blocking the creation and distribution of open educational resources. I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. Barriers. Who gets funded? You look at who gets funded. It's always the institution. It's you know, at the manager or the higher level. I shouldn't say always. That's not completely true. But you know what I mean. Typically, it's the institution that gets funded. But the institution is very often the organization or entity that's telling its members or individuals not to be producing these resources. The scale of funding, the large scale, the large centralized project, and then I speak from very direct personal experience on that, you know, $1 million project. And I look at the initiatives that are actually producing things of value. The top of my mind right now is a resource called ELGG. It's sort of a small scale, non-institutional, and can't get even the minimal level of funding that it wants. And yet, there are millions of dollars available for these large scale projects that hire teams of developers. And it's just backwards. The type of project where there's much emphasis on the production, much emphasis on what is, in a way, euphemistically called quality control, as opposed to projects that are decentralized, that are consumer-focused, that allow people to create rather than simply read. Even things like licensing, I could go on for a long time about licensing, but for the sake of everyone in the room that I won't, but requirements and constraints and restrictions are imposed that make it hard for small organizations or individuals or communities to produce materials. I mean, in a self-formed group that collects around Wikipedia or eBay, which is odd to me, but you know, they don't care about licensing, and they don't want to have to worry about attributions and authorship and all of that. They just want to produce resources. Justification, quality. The whole idea that it's necessary to come and prove in some kind of measurable way that the resource being produced is having an impact adds a huge cost to the production of that thing. And my own experience, and you know, I try to do open stuff, and I find myself spending as much time defending the work that I'm doing from, the skeptics and the critics as actually producing the work. And, you know, in that kind of situation, particularly as it goes on year after year after year, because the justifications never end, it becomes very tiring. And for people who are volunteers, they sort of say, but why am I doing this? I don't know why I'm doing this. The people who are supposed to be funding it and supporting it, they express skepticism. They don't believe it has any value. I know it has value because I see the community. But you can't measure that. You can't measure a conversation. Well, you can, but think about what it costs to do that. Even the narrow view of sustainable, and again, I come back to the previous presentation, and the idea that, yeah, if we have some kind of financial mechanism, and, you know, I'm sort of tempted, I won't exactly say that, I'm sort of tempted to say, you know, people who are producing open educational resources don't want the money. You know, that's not true, though. I know they do, but they don't want the millions of dollars. But they don't want what they are doing to be defined in commercial terms. Because it changes the very nature of what they are trying to do. And then finally, I put down access and control. My experience, I work with a lot of people who are bloggers, edu-bloggers, people who produce wikis, people who produce audio content, podcasts, and I go into these communities, and I talk to people, and the primary experience that they relate to me is that access to their resources is blocked, just simply blocked by the institutions that they're trying to serve. I'm talking about blogging and having students produce their own educational resources. Because we know the value of that. We've actually understood the value of that. And I'm in Edson, we have to do a special setup because the default position in Edson is any weblog system is blocked. James Farmer in Australia, who now produces something called EduBlogs. It's a free educational blog for anybody who wants it. And again, access to his system is typically blocked, and his employers told him to cease and desist and stop talking about open resources and open source. And so it's these sorts of barriers that I allude to, where, you know, I think that more could be done to support the sustainability of open educational resources by removing the barriers, to stop trying to make sure that they're sustainable and to just let this process happen. Because I think the process is happening. I think we can see it. I think there's overwhelming abundance of evidence on the internet now. And the big problem is how to let it happen. How to let the producers produce, the consumers produce, the information to flow freely. If we can get rid of those barriers, the money is a secondary issue. And that's basically what I came here to say. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for people to interrupting and presentation of the money series. I'm not that often interrupting, but I'm really and
while we are doing this, can we talk about the income capability? Because I'm not sure. First of all, first is, I don't know how much we have seen the connection side and it's familiar with our goals, and because none of them be clear about one thing. Regardless of the attempts to construe or misconstrue connections in Africa, we are as open education as anyone else. Okay? So we have no goals of commercializing connections into making money or any such nefarious goals. So we don't have anything like this. So let me be clear about that. The second thing is, I'm not sure other teams trying to characterize these two presentations as being incompatible. I talked about eBay-ability, he talked about eBay-ability. I talked about Wikipedia, he talked about Wikipedia. I talked about the value of building a user community and high quality content needed. So I would like to know exactly what the incompatibility is.
Well, I mean, talking about the same thing.
Yeah,
so does it doesn't mean that we said the same thing about them.
So let's talk about incompatibility. So you're trying to characterize my presentation as being incompatible to open education and principles of open education. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, and just so you know, I am familiar with connections. In fact, I reviewed connections for Innovate or Technologies course. And so I've been throughout connections. And I mean, connections is a very typical initiative in many ways. And I'm not surprised that it developed the way it did. But, and allow me to express this cynically, it seems to me that the primary beneficiary of connections is connections. That the motivation is to promote connections. Actually, I do have an account on connections. Yes. But it's still the model.
There is an issue in Paul's presentation. He drew very rightly on Martin Lennox and drew the Lennox model. Now, the problem to me with the rest of the presentation is he didn't say, we're building a great brand for Lennox. He said, Lennox, the open source top level. Now, I think we have to start with mostly open education resources, and I come very much from the European perspective on this. If we can develop a collaborative infrastructure for open education resources as a whole, and minimize competition within that, I worry when I look at the North American thing, that you're all basically running out of foundation funding, and your market is your own brand. Your brand is not Lennox, your brand is Red Hat. And your marketing potentially is, as you absolutely rightly said, scarce resources, you're marketing against each other.
Right.
Now, I think within a part of your promotion is supposed to say, look at my brand.
Right.
Now, we have a tradition within Europe, sort of public education and a collaboration. And I think there is an issue, and I don't want to see at least in Europe develop that we get big brand lines marching against each other. We need collaborative infrastructure working together, and I think it's how we develop our communities in that way. So this meeting is being in that way, so I would admit that there are some very, very stark differences, not between individual things, but between the different models in North America and the entire world.
I don't necessarily know that we have a lot.
they think that that's what you are allowing is that you have to go determine the international term of OER for government control by primarily developing countries.
It's better than you sound like.
Yeah. But there is a danger of that.
Connections. I'm just one small connection, and my global and focus within connections to the web. Okay? So that people just like you as idealistic as you, as interested in the sort of philosophy and the technical side and all of that information. I'm just one small business oriented scholar. And within that pragmatic role, my concern that our values for the table the next project is how are we going to be sustainable and in the revenue terms over the long term. Okay? So this branding, so this is my perspective. It is not all about branding. Okay, there are people who are our founder Rich, Rich Rami, he's an engineer, I can tell you about more about connections if you like. But please, I mean, don't misunderstand and miscategorize connections. It's a much, much larger thing than what I was able to talk about on the TV. Okay.
I mean,
You heard me correctly, yes, that what I'm stressing is that community-based user as producer model. Well, yeah, because unless you adopt some kind of position like that, then yes, there are limited resources. And when there are limited resources, there is competition. And when there is competition, the marketers win. And that runs against the possibility of producing open educational resources, because it creates this mechanism, this infrastructure, this whole set of expenses that has nothing to do with the content, has nothing to do with learning. You know, I mean, and Connections is not unique. And I pick on Connections, and I do know Connections very well. I've spent a lot of time on that site. And it's not unique. But again, Connections is expressive of the idea that the marketing comes before. And to me, what it comes down to, and this is going to be really critical in the use and acceptance of these resources, is ownership. Now, I go to Connections. I have my own content, maybe, if I can get it out of the system. But it's their site. And you know, it's their thing. And it's not mine. It's not ours. It's theirs. They are the ones with the marketing. They're the ones with the brand, right? The OER brand. I have nothing to do with the OER brand.
I'm going to go to the next one.
language is that a community that has a legal or a legal.
Because. And I know I'm walking out, I'll be very brief. We looked at this. We looked at how people learn. Particularly when they're in an environment where they work or where they live. And we found the first thing they do is ask someone they know. Right? And that's not a case of Brent. At, it's the last resort where they go to Google or go something there, go something like that, or eBay even. That's the last resort. That's not the first resort. Well, we measured it. That's one of the good things that people like. We had numbers. Okay, but now think about this. Doing a search on Google, you're not looking at the brands or the resources that are popping up. Google is basically a recommender system. A very massive one that is basically a recommender system.
When considering the sustainability models, I think it's very important to see also what we want to sustain in the sense that there will be different sustainability models for different things. So, and they will have disadvantages for the thing that you are doing. So, what we need to sustain is especially the maybe the authoring, the localization, the public. So that would be major things to have the complete system working. For instance, for the authoring, you might have a governmental thing. For discovery, you might have a certain institution. For the localization, you might have a community. You can't discuss this in the core. You have to discuss it in the context. The discovery and localization. Those are the most important things that we need to be discussed. And in addition, you might say we need to sustain a community approach to certain motivation that we need to have. If you want to follow a community sustainability model.
Well, I think the problem is, because it doesn't sustain where we are. But But I think we've got to come back to the social individuals and organisations, and it's amazing because I've got this word in social impact. If you look on there, the Etienne Zenger, his first page, he goes as far as saying, if you get to compare that with it, a website is not a community. And I think that means saying and repeating 500 times over, a website is not a community. I am a member of many communities. We're all members of multiple communities. Now, identification is an individual not institutions. And that is critical to the people who have been done there.
Very
good
to make a little bit of a
I think his definition of community is very important because he said a community is defined on the basis of practice, of actual practice. And identity comes on the point of that actual practice. So we identify with spaces where we have effective practices, and those will be all over the space we refer. So if we're due to this taking period, we will tend to relate to the community we are part of, not necessarily the institution worker. That doesn't mean we're not happy to contribute into the institution repository, but we won't identify with the community in that direction. And that is really important to sustainability.
I'll be in the next. 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 I'll
But I'm not, I mean, that misrepresents my position. I'm not saying one thing good, other thing bad. Okay.